This American politician, who's now the most powerful evangelical on the political scene publicly, he is one of the most powerful evangelical people in the world now. And he's saying that this whole thing is a fulfillment. His trip there is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy because he thinks it's his job, just like some of the other representatives we saw. It's their job to bring about this final system. And all this support that they have for Israel isn't necessarily because they're politically supporting Israel. It's because they want to fulfill this Bible prophecy. What most people don't realize is that Benjamin Netanyahu's real last name is Milakowski. His father changed it when he came over in the 1920s. He moved to Palestine, and his father was a hardcore Zionist. He changed his name in the 1920s from Milakowski to Netanyahu. Both of these groups, both of these families, are hardcore Zionists.
We're making a video talking about this specific thing. It's going to be a little mini documentary. The working title is America in Prophecy. So keep an eye out for that. Out the next couple weeks or so, we're going to start releasing that, hopefully.
I'm not sure there's anything more like tangible and important that people can understand to realize all this stuff is true, that the U.S. is going to unite church and state.
Yeah.
Like, watch for that. The evangelical power will be behind it. People like Mike Johnson, people like these Christian Zionist groups.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another Truth Matters episode. We thank you for joining us, and I'm here again with Matt Shaunshay.
Hey, Mackenzie. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. We have a lot to talk about, but I just wanted to say thank you for joining on all of our different platforms, whether that's Facebook, Instagram, ADTV.watch, which is the main platform that we want everybody to get used to, and we have started really rolling out with our resource section. So if people want resources to lectures that they've seen, oh, I liked that chart or I liked these quotes, go to ADTV.watch, and below the video in the resource section has that information there. And we're adding those in to Truth Matters episodes as well. They might not be there instantly, but if you check back.
Yeah, previous episodes has some.
So we have some on the previous episodes, and we're backdating that now that that function is there.
Yeah.
So be patient as we keep adding those things in.
Yeah. And we have done that with what? Total Onslaught, Genesis Conflict, like some of the best series that we have these resources available, and you guys should go check it out and go and dig. I remember thinking, oh man, I wish I had access to these things all these years ago when I was watching it. So now giving access to people to these resources that are in the presentations is hopefully really powerful. And we encourage you to share it, use it, witness with it, make your own sermons or presentations with it. It's all about sharing and spreading the gospel message. We're also hearing your comments. We hear you guys when you're writing down below, when you're going to ADTV.watch and you're giving us that feedback in the comments section. We're getting it right along to our engineering teams and making sure we're working out any issues. So that's very helpful when you guys are doing that. It also is encouraging for us that you guys are hearing that we're going to be migrating over to ADTV.watch. We all have to keep in mind that at some point, Truth Matters will not be allowed to continue on YouTube.
Yeah.
And so we will eventually get our Rumble channel up and running. There's just been a lot of stuff happening, and it's hard to get all of it taken care of. But getting Rumble up and getting people, even if it's not perfect in every way yet, get used to going over to ADTV.watch. Help us with the feedback so we can get this cleaned up. Because by the time we get kicked off YouTube, we want pretty much everybody to know where to go and what to do.
Yeah. Since we're going into this episode that is going to be very Bible study heavy, you know, we've had a couple in the past who are very Bible study heavy, and this one is too, because we're talking about a prophecy in the Bible that some people are saying is way in the past, some people are saying is not so far in the past, in the future, and tearing it in pieces. So before we start, I would just like to ask if we could pray. And we'll pray as we go into this study. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are here with us. We ask that your Spirit would be guiding this study, that you'd be with the hearers as well, that you'd give them discernment and give us discernment, that we would say the words that are from you and not our own. We thank you for this, In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Well, Mackenzie, we just did two episodes tackling some normal evangelical and Protestant errors as we looked at Robert Breaker and how he looked at the Sabbath and the law of God versus the law of Moses. And we had all this stuff that we tackled in that. And this is kind of like continuing on a little bit in that mold. And I think the source of most of the error that we're seeing when it comes to end time eschatology and what the various viewpoints are on that. Robert Breaker actually does a video on the 70 weeks that maybe at some point we'll look at down the line, because it represents this prophecy that almost every Bible-based religion is looking at and saying that it's important, but for different reasons, and leading to totally different outcomes than I think what the Bible actually says. And so what we're going to look at is the end time error of the 70 weeks of Daniel 9. This is, we're going to come to find both the understanding of the role of Judaism and the Jewish nation in all of this, as well as where the evangelicals go wrong and people like Robert Breaker and many, many, many others. I can't tell you on the social media accounts how many people are expounding this end time era, that there's coming a rapture, a pre-tribulation rapture, a 7-year period that is in the future where the Antichrist arises and makes this covenant. There's billions, literally billions of people who are impacted by the view on this particular prophecy. And I think what we're going to try to do is get to the bottom of it by looking at all the views, putting them side by side, putting everything in context. So yes, it will be very Bible study heavy, but for anybody who really wants to understand if this end time understanding of the third temple and the rapture and the Antichrist is correct, this is the type of topic that you should be able to watch regardless of what denomination you're from and get something out of it.
And if we don't understand this correctly, then it's going to be a domino effect into us being deceived in the end by different things that are going to happen, right? If we don't have our events right and our events are pointing to something else, that can lead us to be in big trouble.
Yeah. And we are probably, as we've talked about before, one of the only ministries that points to American Protestantism as the role of this false prophet. So if that understanding really is correct, then it's not just the error of like a Christian group that has an error in a doctrine. It's actually the error of the false prophet that's going to intentionally be designed, whether the people who are expounding that position or not realize it, intentionally designed to skew the real identity of the Antichrist and to skew the real end time eschatology, especially as it relates to American Protestantism and the uniting of church and state. Yeah. Most of the false prophet never can identify themselves as this because they don't understand the 70 weeks of Daniel 9. And so we're going to pull this apart probably much deeper than most people have gone into this.
It's going to be several episodes, that's for sure.
Yeah. And the reason we're doing that is because if at the end of however, if it's 3 or 4 episodes at the end of this, hopefully anybody who's interested or comes at some point down the line on this topic is interested in what all the views believe and why and how they arrived at those. This would be the type of series that you could share with those people. And it, hopefully it's a fair, as balanced as we can be, being from one of the viewpoints, a fair and balanced look at all of them and how they arrive at them, and try to be as neutral as possible as we're looking at this and just let the Bible lead us to the conclusion of which worldview has this correct, or do any of them have this correct? Are they all wrong?
Yeah.
But getting to the bottom of this, I think, will be helpful for us as a whole, trying to sort out the details of the end times.
Mm-hmm.
So we had covered fairly recently Project 2025. And it's that 900-page document that says if the Republicans win the coming presidential election, they're going to overturn all of the Biden economics, immigration,
climate change
policies, all the woke agenda of the left. They're going to come sweep this out. And we saw in the process that there's been a new head of the House of Representatives, a new Speaker of the House, a guy named Mike Johnson. Mm-hmm. And we pointed out Mike Johnson has a history both litigating in the courts, church and state issues, where he's advocating for the church to influence the government. But we also saw he has ties and interests in Israel specifically and the rebuilding of the Third Temple. Now, all of this ties back to the 70 weeks. So we wanted, rather than to just dive right into the Bible, make sure that there's a real world connection and show people how this is actually unfolding in the world today and how Mike Johnson, being a powerful evangelical, is really accelerated this Third Temple timeline. So we see during a trip to Israel, Mike Johnson connected with far-right extremists, and we're going to look at who those far-right extremists are here in a bit. This is an article that I think every person should pause this screen and go take this URL and go read this article, because it looks at how the GOP, or the Republican Party for the most part, is working and has been working for years behind the scenes to get this establishment of the temple site to be in control of the Jews, where right now it's currently in control of the Muslims. And so this is from 2022. This author, Corey Sherman, goes through and I think does a remarkable job of real investigative journalism, showing the details of this Republican power looking to build this third temple. Article, you find 9 Republican politicians named as specifically going overseas to Israel, paid on secret trips. These were not made known to the public until fairly recently. And we're going to look at why here in a bit. This includes Ohio Representative Jim Jordan, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former North Carolina Rep Mark Meadows, former Vice President Mike Pence, Maryland Representative Andy Harris, West Virginia Rep. David McKinley, former Colorado Rep. Scott Tipton, Louisiana Rep. Mike Johnson, who the article calls an evangelical minister. They didn't even know he was a politician, that he was seen in that role as an evangelical minister, and Texas Representative Louis Gohmert. And so what I find fascinating is some of these names are up for presidential spots. Ron DeSantis is up there. He's a powerful Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. He is part of the Order of St. Elmo and also part of a couple of other Catholic orders. And you see there's a mixture of Protestant and Catholic here, but the evangelicals are the most zealot of the group to get this third temple built.
So when we look at this here, we see these different groups. These politicians participated in secretive trips to Israel, like we mentioned, guided by Boyan Danu in Our Hands, a Jewish Third Temple extremist group, and funded by United States Israel Education Association and Proclaiming Justice to Nations, Christian Zionist organizations. So these organizations literally are trying to take over Palestine and involved in some very heinous things.
Well, not necessarily Palestine as much as the temple site.
The temple site, yes.
In Jerusalem.
The temple site.
Yeah. And so this In Our Hands group, this is the right wing, you know how it said in this previous slide, during his trip, he was connected to far-right extremist groups. The far-right extremist group is this In Our Hands group.
Yeah.
This is not just your casual, like, social justice, we're going to, you know, stand outside with some picket signs. This is actually, this group was founded by a gentleman who was arrested because he attempted to murder several Palestinians. Like, it's a violent political action organization. So that's why the article said it's an extreme right-wing group. Mm-hmm. So when they're going over there, they're being guided by this Jewish group that's like a violent organization.
And these guys are all connected. So you can see that they have one vision and one goal in this.
Exactly.
Even though they seem like they're from not exactly the same viewpoint.
And the article really expounds interestingly on that. And the last two, the United States Israel Education Association and Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, those are both American organizations. And it says that they're Christian Zionist organizations.
Yeah.
What that basically means is these Christian groups are so interested in Israel setting up this supremacist Jewish supreme state, that because without that state, they can't rebuild the third temple.
Right.
And they can't rebuild the third temple until they get control of this site. So you kind of see the trickle effect that this has. And these two organizations are paying for American politicians to go over and use their political clout and their religious worldview to start pushing for what has been decades-long diplomatic issues over this territory. So I found it fascinating that Mike Johnson's in there, Mike Pence is in there, yeah. Ron DeSantis is in there. Those are some big names, and that they're working for groups whose goal is to establish this Israeli nation, and there just happens to be a conflict going on over there right now.
And these aren't just, I want to see the Holy Land type trips.
No, otherwise it wouldn't be secretive.
Right. This is because there is a bigger plan at play. There's a bigger, agenda. And there's a big reason why. And this all connects back to, like we're mentioning, this 70-week prophecy in Daniel,
mm-hmm.
and how they're understanding this and where, you know, who this is being affected by, the tribulation, and so on and so forth.
In fact, I'll say this is exclusively why they're interested in going over there, is because they want to set up this their temple so they can get this 70th week started,
yep.
and be raptured out of here before anything bad happens. Of course, we know that's not what the Bible teaches, but we'll look at that closer at another time. So we're going to peek at some, this is a long article. So we're just going to peek at a couple of things that kind of gives us an idea of what we're saying is not just our words, but is exactly what this investigative journalist found. Again, this is from 2022, and that's going to become important when we look at Mike Johnson and what he did as soon as he got into the head speaker role of the House. In 2018, for example, Sham Richman, the Temple Institute's former international director, the Temple Institute is another one of these interesting organizations that's sole goal is to bring about the rebuilding of the Third Temple.
Yeah.
And they have deep ties in with the Proclaiming Justice Nations and this extremist group In Our Hands. Like, they are all working. The Temple Institute is there, regardless of if it's Christian or Jewish, to get this one end goal done. So he escorted West Virginia Rep. David McKinley and then Colorado Rep. Scott Tipton on a tour of Alaska as part of a trip sponsored by the Christian Zionist organization Proclaiming Justice to the Nations, which pursues complete Jewish control in Israel and Palestine based on the belief that it will bring about the end of days and the second coming of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
So Christian Zionist is usually thought of as a Jewish thing, and the Jews reject Jesus. So, but in Christian Zionism, they are trying to bring about the end of days early,
yeah.
as early as possible, so they can bring about the second coming of Jesus.
And this plays into, if you know prophecy and if you know sort of the timeline of end time events, when Jesus comes and how that all comes about, if you're looking towards something and they have this understanding, we also know, and we've mentioned, that there's going to be false Christ and Satan will eventually come as Christ. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking for something that he can twist and he can put into his flow of events, then you might be deceived. It won't be Jesus. It'll be actually Satan impersonating as Jesus. And as the Bible says, even the very elect could be deceived.
Yeah, and the reason they're not is because they're so conversant with their Bibles and they know their prophecy so well that
right.
they can't. But if you don't know these things, you'll be told a version of what prophecy supposedly says. And because Satan can bring about these events, doesn't mean that they're prophetic, even though there is a worldview that says they're prophetic.
Yep.
And that has to be a very key point that anybody who's really interested in surviving what's coming here
yep.
needs to understand. Because if you trust what the world is going to do, they may rebuild the Third Temple. They may do all these things that have nothing to do necessarily with Bible prophecy as much as it is to confuse people from the truth
yes.
and from the fiction.
That's why we have to be among the wise and not among the foolish.
That's right.
Because the foolish will be deceived, but the wise are able to see.
And we're trying to present an evidence-based case for why the view that we advocate is true. Because we're not just saying, like, believe it because we say it. We're not only going in the Bible, we're connecting it with the real-world institutions, the real-world political figures that yeah. are playing a role in all of this. And we're saying, watch out for America, watch out for evangelical Protestantism that's going to have supernatural help at some point. And it may just be what's needed to push this over the edge. And now that a conflict has started over in Israel and Palestine, watch, something could happen to that Temple Mount site. We just don't yeah. know. But it would be within the flow of wartime events, and nobody would bat an eye.
Yeah.
So continuing, the article says Johnson, an evangelical minister, and I added, and the Speaker of the House of the U.S. Representatives, mm-hmm. because the article just called him an evangelical yeah. minister. How many people do you think, if you asked in the United States today, walked up to people on the street and said, how do you feel about having a hardcore evangelical minister as the head of one of your political houses of lawmaking?
They wouldn't even know who you're referencing, most likely.
That's probably true. They probably don't even know who Mike Johnson is. They probably don't care whether he would be an evangelical minister, but usually somebody with like that much of, like, you don't see pastors and ministers generally taking head political leadership mm-hmm. positions. And the fact that he said, he described his tour of Israel as, quote, the fulfillment of a biblical prophecy, and argued that the status quo at the Esplanade was a jarring example of the restriction of Jews and Christians' freedoms and of expression and worship.
That shows how important this is to them.
They think that it's their job to bring about the building of this temple. This yeah. American politician, who's now the most powerful evangelical on the political scene publicly, I'm not saying behind the scenes he is, he obviously isn't, but publicly, he is one of the most powerful evangelical people in the world now. And he's saying that this whole thing is a fulfillment, his trip there is a fulfillment of Bible prophecy, because he yeah. thinks it's his job, just like some of the other representatives we saw, it's their job to bring about this final system. And all this support that they have for Israel isn't necessarily because they're politically supporting Israel. It's because they want to fulfill this Bible prophecy.
So it continues here saying, should the GOP return to power in this fall's midterms, the temple movement's allies in Congress will be in an even better position to continue chipping away at the diplomatic censuses. To the benefit...
So let's just pause there sure. for a second. Because it's saying at the time in October 2022, when this was written, that if they win the midterms, this movement for the Third Temple would gain a lot of momentum. And what happened is they won the midterms. Mm-hmm. The Republicans won. And by January of 2023, they had the taken back the House. And by November of 2023, Mike Johnson is the new Speaker
yeah.
of the House. So the article was a little prophetic in its own right in saying that if this change happens, if the Republicans win, which yeah. they did, the chipping away was going to continue. And that's exactly what happened.
So it continues here, to the benefit of the political fringe, although the House cannot unilaterally usher in the changes that the temple movement demands, Republican leaders like Jordan could, for example, pass congressional resolutions calling on the U.S. to revoke its support for the status quo at Al-Aqsa or condition congressional appropriations on such moves.
So basically they're saying, like, even if they can't, like, the House can't just be like, we're supporting Israel with all the money and all the weapons.
Just strong hand it.
Yeah, they can't strong hand it. But what they can do is they can start making political resolutions yeah. to say, hey, we withdraw. You remember when Trump moved the embassy? We talked about that in the Project 2025 at length. Now you can see this is the type of political support, what it can do. They moved it the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Yep.
Now this is how you start revoking support for the mosque being there, because you're moving your embassy.
Yep.
Now you have politicians on board.
Well, it's
now
little saying, things at a time.
Exactly.
Right? Just chipping away at that thing until we get our resolution.
And I think there's no bigger testament to that happening than the fact that they've moved the embassy there. That almost, like, without people realizing it, is like the major first step of the Third Temple being rebuilt.
For Jewish people, maybe it's not, doesn't seem that big, because they're like, oh, well, this was always the capital. But the fact that now America has done that and others are acknowledging this shows the emphasis
yeah.
and how... Just like it's saying here, if these resolutions just keep going, they're really increasing that momentum in this direction.
Yeah.
Because they, like you said, he viewed it as a biblical fulfillment
of prophecy, that he thinks that they're, you know, over time responsible for getting this thing rebuilt. And it's accelerated even more when, like, you know, everyone's waiting for Trump to get back in and for, you know, all of this 2025 stuff to go down. But Johnson came in yeah. under the Biden administration. The acceleration has occurred. He did not move the embassy back. Biden kept the embassy mm-hmm. in Jerusalem. So we see, like, it's speeding up in, like, the move towards this Republican God-based government under Trump seems to be accelerating at a rapid pace.
Yeah.
If nothing else, the GOP could use such measures to put the temple movement's vision into wider circulation. And that's kind of what we're talking about, just the general influence. The move to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, they actually passed a resolution in 95, decades before Trump actually did so. So we see that, like, Trump continued a process. He didn't start it. That the idea to move eventually this embassy to Tel Aviv started in 1995.
Yeah.
But it didn't take them, what was this, 20, 30 years later
mm-hmm.
to finally get the right president at the right time with the right Jared Kushner. We'll get into him at some point, him and his relation and Peter Thiel and these guys behind the scenes that are moving things that most people don't realize. all this has been happening and is culminating in the movement of things going toward the building of this third temple. So the temple movement knows how to build power. That's an interesting statement. The Temple Institute is different than the temple movement, is different than the Our Hands people, is different. So you see all of these different groups moving towards making this happen. But look at what he says after that. It says, evangelicals and congressmen provide the movement with access to funding and political support. So they see that, let's say from the Jewish perspective, why would you be so on board in getting these politicians over here? Because these are the guys that can really change the narrative and get you the money and the funding needed to get this movement really moving. It says at the end, I think this is an important point. Both sides seek total Jewish sovereignty in the area, if for different reasons, he said. Both groups are using each other for their own goals. How fascinating is that? One group wants to build it because they, well, let's take a look. Before we get there, this was in 2022. And in November 2023, Mike Johnson is Speaker of the House. The very first thing he does is pass or propose a $14 billion aid bill to Israel. So like we see, he sees this prophetic fulfillment. He's not even speaker. He gets into the House and the very first thing he does is bring to the floor something that will bring forth more momentum towards the building of this third temple. It says in his first major initiative as GOP House Speaker, Mike Johnson, the evangelical minister, according to the article, pushed through a bill to provide a $14 billion in military assistance to Israel. Israel doesn't need a ceasefire, he declared before the vote. It needs its allies to deliver support now. Why would they want so much support? They don't want the ceasefire.
Yeah.
Because the ceasefire won't bring about the conditions to getting that temple site.
They need the conflict in order to create the synthesis.
Exactly. So you can see here, he's not interested in ending the conflict.
Yeah.
It's not about peace. He says we need to deliver support now. Why is he so interested in it? Well, in February of that year, Johnson traveled to Israel with Representative Republican Jim Jordan. The sponsor for this trip was the New York-based 12 Tribes Film Foundation, a small outfit that describes themselves as online warriors for truth about Israel and the Jewish people. So I find this fascinating, the 12 tribes concept. This is going back to the sons of Jacob and the 12 sons he had. They became the 12 tribes of Israel. And there are factions of Christians and Jews today that fight over the idea of these 12 tribes still being around, but that these types of groups are funding, again, our politicians to go overseas to Israel. And then as they have years of effort over there, Johnson comes in there and is ready immediately with this aid package.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a coincidence. It's 1 year after this article was released. So we see a lot of American support for this third temple to be built from the from a evangelical Christian and political perspective. Recently, Javier Milei, the new president of Argentina, just went to Jerusalem. And he stood in front of an important monumental site and gave this speech where he basically says, we need to rebuild the third temple. He goes on to cite prophecy as a means of believing that the third temple needs to be rebuilt. But when you understand where the prophecy is from, it's not from the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the Talmud.
Yeah.
And these people have connections back. People think he's strictly Argentinian, but we're going to look at some interesting details. But first, let's hear what the Argentinian president has to say about the rebuilding. And I apologize for the grainy video. It's the best quality we could get. I couldn't find another better one.
Construction del segundo templo a mano de los romanos. This story took place after the destruction of the second temple by the Romans. Se encontraban Rabbi Akiva y sus colegas observando el monte del templo en ruinas, y vieron a un sordo salir del lugar más santo de lo que era el templo. Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues were observing the Temple Mount in ruins, and they saw a fox leave the holiest of holies in the temple. No podría haber una escena más desalentadora que aquella. There could have been no more disheartening scene than that. Frente a esta terrible escena, los rabinos lloraron en señal de duelo, pero Rabbi Akiva comenzó a reír. In the face of this terrible scene, the rabbis cried in mourning, but Rabbi Akiva started to laugh. Su colega le preguntaron cómo podía reír frente a semejante tragedia, a lo que Rabbi Akiva respondió. His colleagues asked how he could possibly laugh in the face of such a tragedy, to which Rabbi Akiva answered. Hay una profecía acerca de la destrucción que relata que un zorro irrumpiría en el lugar más santo. there's a prophecy about the destruction that says that a fox will break into the holiest of holies.
También hay otra profecía que relata que este mismo lugar será reconstruido.
There is another prophecy that says that the same place will be rebuilt.
Ahora que veo con mis propios ojos cumplirse la primera profecía,
now that I see with my own eyes the first prophecy come true,
me río de alegría y esperanza, ya que de seguro se cumplirá la segunda profecía.
I laugh in joy and full of hope, as the second prophecy will surely come true.
Esperanza, ya que de seguro se cumplirá la segunda profecía.
I laugh in joy and full of hope, as the second prophecy will surely come true.
How many presidents around the world are quoting Jewish Talmudic prophecies as non-Jews?
I would say none.
Not that I've seen. Maybe there are, but it's not anything mainstream or anybody.
Yeah.
So it is particularly
especially
interesting.
Especially intricate ones.
Yeah. Because that's a Talmud one about the Holy of Holies and the rebuilding of this. And what I find kind of crazy is like there is no prophecy in the Talmud. There is no such thing as prophecy outside of the Bible. In a couple of other presentations I've done and sermons I've done, I've shown the difference between, let's say, a Nostradamus versus something in the Talmud versus something in the Zohar versus something in the Bible.
Yeah.
And they're incomparable. The Bible stands alone. And so he could have cited some things. He could have cited Daniel 9, 24 through 27 or something along the lines that pointed to, you know, a Bible-based prophecy, but he's choosing the Talmud. And I want to, without veering too far off, because we're just going to touch on this, I want to show people that what we're seeing on the world stage is not what we think, but what we're seeing is planned out. And they're pulling the strings to the point that even these new president, I mean, the guy was a former sex coach before he became president of Argentina. And he's also a World Economic Forum alum.
Obviously.
And we can get into Klaus Schwab and who started the World Economic Forum and who's behind Klaus Schwab. We'll get to at some point. But Javier Milei is not his real name. Most people don't realize this. His name is actually Javier Milikowski. And his father is Noberto Milikowski. And when you look into the surname Milikowski, it is strictly from Jewish heritage. It's a Jewish last name. It's indicative of Eastern European Jewish ancestry. And when you look at Norberto's background and where his family and kind of follow it back, these are all like Polish, Eastern European Jewish people. Mm-hmm. He's not actually exactly who he says he is. What most people don't realize is that Benjamin Netanyahu's real last name is Milikowski. His father changed it when he came over in the 1920s. He moved to Palestine, and his father was a hardcore Zionist. He changed his name in the 1920s from Milikowski to Netanyahu. Both of these groups, both of these families are hardcore Zionists. And who did we see paid for the politicians to come over to Israel? Christian Zionists. Yeah. So these families, people probably don't know that Netanyahu's real last name is Milikowski, or that Milei actually is, you can see that the son's face. I mean, it's the exact same person. That these are all connected to the same Zionist, pro-Zionist movement. So when he goes over there, Javier, and he's got his yarmulke on, and he's you know, wailing at the wall, and he's crying tears, I believe it's because he's actually Jewish. And he actually has connections back to this land. He's maybe not who he seems to be. They tend to pick these actors. I mean, look at Zelensky. Before Zelensky was the president of Ukraine at this crazy time, he was a comedy actor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they go into these places and they find who meets the figure, the fake, you know, person, persona that they're supposed to be, and they put him out on the world stage. And this is kind of what we're seeing now.
And we could get into all sorts of things about different people who are part of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we see that in America. We see, and the funny thing is that people almost, they idolize these people, and then they see their persona or what they are as an actor or whatever, and think, wow, that would be a great president because I like their personality. They're friendly, they're funny, they're this and they're that. And then they don't really realize what they're saying. They're asking for someone who's not really that person.
Mm.
because these people are not really those people. This is a caricature that they're putting on, a persona, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's like the great WWE all over.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we can see that, like you said, everywhere. In American elections, in Canadian elections, Trudeau and his connection to the Castro family, you just see these guys are placed in the proper places. And we see here that this is a connection I found quite fascinating. So the bottom line is, the Christian world and the political Zion and Judaism world are all looking for
the third temple,
but for different reasons. On the evangelical side, it's to help usher in the Antichrist, Messiah, and rapture, because they say it's to bring in the Messiah, but before the Messiah comes, by their own understanding, Satan needs to come and set up this Antichrist, set up this 7-year agreement with the Jewish people. And then on the Judaism and political Zionism side, they're using the third temple as a basis to usher in the Messiah, because from the rabbi that I talked to, he said that the Messiah needs to be here for the sacrificial system to be reinstituted. Yeah. I don't know if he needs to be here for the temple to be rebuilt, but I think it's kind of some within the...
If they rebuild the temple, then he will arrive and then they can have the great reunion and start the system.
Exactly. Over. So the third temple very much coincides with the Messiah, even in the Jewish view, yeah. to reinstitute the sacrificial services and establish Judaism as like this global, supreme global
yeah.
head.
Which is very interesting, because we're looking at it from two very different angles. One is anti-Christian, one is Christian,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But somehow they're both looking to the third temple, and really the end is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have the false understanding of the chain of events, you're both going to be looking for the same event. And that false event, without saying too much, you know, before we get into everything, you will be culminating on this unified untruth, basically.
Mm-hmm. And that's what Satan's looking to do. That's why the deception is so good, because it's like this unifying deception. And I just wanted people to understand where we kind of sit on this, but that the Vatican controls all of this. Rome behind the scenes is controlling political Zionism. It's controlling the upper echelons of Judaism. And there's probably going to be people who just go ballistic and say, no, the Jews are in control. No, the Jews are in control.
If you look at one of our earliest episodes, we go down like the pyramid structure and break down all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Go take a look. I think it's right on the thumbnail. The pyramid structure is Zionists are not, you know, the base of the pyramid.
No, they're not. They're not the capstone. I think we're going to go deeper into this in future episodes. We've got a lot more details that we can give people. But through Jesuitism, through groups like the Knights of Malta, the Order of the Garter, the Sacred Military Order of Constantinian St. George, these are very, very powerful
yeah.
Christian-looking orders, as we've talked about at length in even the blockchain episodes, like how they're using these orders to influence. These people in those orders, they control these movements.
Mm-hmm.
From evangelical Christianity to political Zionism, they are in control of all of those. And we can even bring the names out, the positions that they hold in the various lodges, and show exactly who's behind this. It's not going to be in this episode, but know that like a lot of this is show for yeah. the Vatican behind the scenes and the papal power and the families who run those powers behind the scenes. So we don't want people to get caught up in this argument right. so much. Behind it all is still the dragon, beast, and false prophet.
But these are the multiple viewpoints that are putting in ideas countering the true viewpoint.
Yeah.
So we have to address, you know, sequentially through so that we hopefully answer some of it, people's
yeah.
questions.
And we want to show that, you know, all, as you said, all these viewpoints are impacted by the 70 weeks of Daniel, which is now coming. Like, people be like, well, who cares what impact somebody's end time view has? But when it's the politicians who are making laws and creating support packages that impact your lives, your tax mm-hmm. dollars, your, you know, whatever happens in your neighborhoods or your communities are dictated by these, a lot of these politicians, you're going to care more and more when their worldview starts creeping into your world.
Yeah. When church and state have no more separation.
Yeah.
Because that's the ultimate goal. Like, we've spoken of before and we've shown, you know, all sorts of things on that. That leads me into, I just want to interject, we're making a video talking about this specific thing. It's going to be a little mini documentary. And we're going to show how this whole culmination of getting rid of the separation of church and state and how this is going to be coming about. The working title is America in Prophecy. Mm-hmm. So keep an eye out for that out the next couple weeks or so. We're going to start releasing that, hopefully.
I'm not sure there's anything more like tangible and important that people can understand to realize all this stuff is true, that the U.S. is going to unite church and state.
Yeah.
Like, watch for that. The evangelical power will be behind it. People like Mike Johnson, people like these Christian Zionist groups. It's going to get bigger and louder. And if people understand that, even if they don't believe it, they'll see it start to happen.
Yeah.
And hopefully the Holy Spirit will move upon them. So this was our really long intro to getting into why Daniel chapter 9 is so important, why it's impacting so many people. Daniel 9 offers arguably the greatest messianic prophecy of the Bible. It predicts the events and the precise timing of the Messiah's ministry. Understanding this chapter in the 70 weeks prophecy will expose the deceptions of the Third Temple and end time eschatology fallacies within Judaism and Christianity. Because when you break all this stuff out, you can have 100 different views, but when only one fits perfectly like a puzzle piece into the space that it's cut for, it doesn't matter how many other puzzle pieces you have. The piece is right for that spot.
And one of the rules of prophetic interpretation is we have to see every single word fulfilled to the T to know that it is correct. If there's one part that's missing, it's not correct.
Not surprisingly, that's where all these like worldviews fall apart. When you really go word by word, line by line, and bring out what it's saying and carry it out to the end, there's one view that falls apart and one view that stands the test. So we're going to continue to look at that. It is one of the most contested prophecies in the Bible and dictates the worldview of, I calculated it, 2.3 billion people are impacted by this.
Right. 100%. This is one of the most critical prophecies because, like you said here, it shows the Messiah. It shows so many things and everything just has to line up. It's not, you know, kind of a conspicuous starting date, and then we can figure out one ending date. It has multiple waymarks all throughout the prophecy, all throughout history, that have to line up exactly to in order to be fulfilled correctly.
Yeah, to even qualify, it has to fit
exactly
every single one. And so as we kind of dig through this, we find that of all the groups in the world, there's four that are expounding some sort of explanation on this. And we'll see later, you know, how this impacts the end time views as you start to play them all out. But Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism, and Adventism, and I should have probably put more like evangelical Christianity, and because I put Adventists separate than Protestants, even though we are Protestants, but we do have distinctly different views than the majority of Protestants. What we would say are the Protestant views we hold, while a lot of Protestants really don't hold Protestant views anymore. So there's a difference. That's the reason there's a difference there. So kind of like setting up how we can dive into this conversation, you really can't just jump right in to 9:24 through 27 and just be like, all right, let's go at it. There's like a much larger story that needs to be put in place and pillars that need to be planted before we can.
What's the context for what we're talking about here? What's the outlay of the land that that we're going to be dissecting? Because that is actually really critical.
Yeah.
Because if you don't understand the foreground, then the details you can like string out every direction.
Yeah. And what we want to do is have somebody who maybe doesn't know anything about this be able to follow along, because it's not just jumping in far into the story. And for people who maybe already know some of this stuff, that this is really to help understand what others see so you can go witness properly to these various groups and have a good foundation to stand on. So before we can dive into like Daniel 9 specifically, just the book of Daniel needs to be established.
Yeah.
There are two views in the world right now. One is that Daniel is the author and that he wrote it around 6th century BC through the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. The second one is that some anonymous Jewish scholar around the 2nd century BC wrote the text. And we're going to look at the reasons why these two views are there and where they came from and so on and so forth. just to be clear, here's the view that thinks that Daniel was the author. This is from my own study Bible, the Remnant Study Bible. It says, Daniel is believed to be the author based on the use of writings in the first person stating in 7:2. And I'll say there's a whole host of other reasons why, and we're going to look at some of those today. But for our view, Daniel is absolutely, it was written by Daniel in 6th century BC.
Yeah.
And when you look at the history of who has looked at this, you know, book, Daniel's, I mean, even Martin Luther, that's like one of the first books he translated into English with Revelation, or into German, excuse me, Daniel and Revelation, that this book has been the focus of many, many scholars in Catholicism, Protestantism, Judaism, and even Islam, because they accept the Torah or parts of it. And you'll notice that prior to the 18th century, there was 100% consensus that Daniel was written in 6th century by Daniel.
Yeah.
So what happened? Let's take a picture into what has happened to modern society. We'll call it the Wikipedia effect.
Yeah.
People using Wikipedia as like this neutral source of good information. And look, does Wikipedia have good information? Sure, it does. But does it mean you can take everything as what it says as face value? Certainly not, especially when you get into biblical understanding and Jesus Christ and the divinity aspect of him. Because I came across this. This is a response from a Wikipedia spokesperson. And this came about because people were writing in saying, hey, your Wikipedia is saying that Daniel was written in the second century and that Moses isn't the author of the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. And here's what this spokesperson had to say. The idea that the book of Daniel has historicity does not fly with mainstream academia. As a historical view, it is not even remotely tenable, meaning it's not even possible.
Yeah.
The folks saying that Daniel was written in the 6th century don't publish in mainstream outlets, generally speaking.
So it has to be mainstream.
And that's what we're looking at. Now, if you just control mainstream outlets, you basically can bank the truth, anything you want, and Wikipedia will back you.
And all the mainstream are owned by all the same people with all the same agenda. So obviously, it's going to have one narrative.
Hence the reason why we have to be very careful with modern scholarship. Because he's saying mainstream outlets, well, if you go, that's rejecting the Jews who have been the best, some of the best historians of all time. All the accounts that they wrote about it, all the accounts that anybody in the, prior to the 18th century who had closer, more, or better access to documents that were closer to the dates, even to the early church fathers, you can see that they all agreed that Daniel was in the 6th century. So they're saying, well, if they don't post in mainstream outlets, therefore it equals not being true.
You'd also have to deny the book itself and its own claims, which we'll kind of get into.
Yeah. So it continues, it says, it's clearer than the sun at noonday that the Pentateuch, which is a Christian way of saying the Torah, I wish you'd just say Torah, was not written by Moses, but by someone who lived long after Moses. So in this response, it's not just Daniel that's rejected. It's now Moses that's rejected as the author. And when you when you reject Moses and Daniel as the authors, who are you actually rejecting?
Christ.
Yeah.
The author of yeah, all the great authors.
Yeah. So Wikipedia will, listen to this, will only listen to mainstream historians and mainstream Bible scholars. I'd really like to understand what mainstream is. Mm-hmm. Because here the Bible is defining a world that's under this false doctrine of Babylon. I would say the false doctrine of Babylon is mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mainstream. And then you have this remnant, this small group of people that's holding on to the commandments of God and the testimony of Jesus, who are telling you the truth, but it's the small minority. And this information source is telling you that we wouldn't consider that truth. Wikipedia is a venue for rendering mainstream scholarship, and we despise so-called, quote, scholars who, in fact, are preaching to their own choir. This is a very snooty response, thinking that they're very smart because, of course, Daniel wasn't written in the 6th century BC. Of course, Moses wasn't the author. But we're going to look at if, like, this were a court case and this is a body of evidence that needed to be presented, who would win and who has more direct evidence versus circumstantial?
Mm-hmm. So when we look here at one of the first points, and this is regarding the second century BC dating, which is the majority view.
Today it is, yeah.
Today it is, yes. Most modern day post-18th century scholars, including Wikipedia, which we just looked at, it suggests that the Book of Daniel was written around the time of the Maccabean Revolt in 167-164 BC. And then we have three points here to this. And the
and
first
this is just to be clear, this is how this is what the second century people are saying is why they don't believe the sixth century and why they do believe the second century.
Right. This view is based on the critique of early authorship based on its detailed knowledge of future events. So basically they're saying, well, it's so accurate, it's just not possible.
That's the number one reason that modern scholars hold this.
It's not too good to be true.
Exactly. Is that scientific?
Not really.
Not really. Because you just let it be true if it is provable through the evidence. If it's true, who cares if it seems unbelievable or not? Let's just see if it's true or not. So
that's probably why they believe in evolution, because it's not so great to believe.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I don't need to go as far in stretching my belief. But I found it fascinating that amongst all the evidence that I could gather for this view, the main supporting reason was because it's so accurate, it had to be written in the future.
Yeah. So then number two, the presence of certain Greek words connected to later eras. Mm-hmm. So that's number two. And number three, and its exclusion from the Sirach and apocryphal book written 150 years after the life of Jesus, which is kind of a terrible argument.
Yeah, and we're going to see why. So let's just break these 3 points down from their view. So it's impossible to tell the future. That's number one. The book of Daniel contains very detailed, accurate descriptions of events from the second century BC, and that level of detail about these events has led many scholars to conclude that the author must have lived during or shortly after these times. Daniel named not in the Syriac, that apocryphal book written by Ben Sira, the Jewish scribe, and then the presence of Greek loanwords. We're going to say these would be my rebuttals to some of those issues. It says the book can't tell the future. Well, in the book, it says specifically declaring the end from the beginning and from the ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, "My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." And I could have put 100 different verses up there. He does nothing but reveal his secrets to his prophets.
And this isn't Daniel speaking.
No.
This is God speaking, and God's the one saying, "I created it all. I will declare from the end from the beginning." So just because Daniel wrote it doesn't mean that he just had such a great mind he could predict the future.
Yeah.
This is coming from God. And if you go into the details, which we will be going into some of the details here, it proves that this is a prophetic book, because there is, even if it was written in the second century BC, there are so many things that it foretold after the second century that... It's almost a null argument, really.
It is.
To go from second to six. Oh, wow. It was only, 200 years before all the events that it was predicting, and only 2,000 years before other events it was predicting.
Basically. But it doesn't just stop at Daniel. Like, if you move the Daniel dates because it said it was so accurate on something that happened before it actually came to pass, you'd have to move books of Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, Psalms, the whole gospel, Revelation. You'd have to start moving the dates of all these books to be after the things that they've predicted. And that just doesn't make any sense. So for somebody who's like saying, well, this is my best argument is because the proof is that you can't tell the future. Well, here we're showing you that the book is saying time and time again and proving that it does. So somebody rejecting the divinity of the Bible itself, the author of the Bible, I don't know how you contend with that other than to say you're dealing with God himself when you're dealing with these books. So I could see being like an atheist and saying that, but using this reasoning as a Christian to say that the book of Daniel, like as a modern Christian scholar, it's kind of embarrassing to me.
Well, here's the thing. When you're reading any sort of literature, book, whether it's a novel, it doesn't matter what it is. When you approach that text, you have to approach it in the context of the book itself. So if you're going to read a book about, let's just take a worldly book, whether it's Harry Potter or whatever, you have to understand the context of the book is this mystical realm of witches and warlocks and whatever it is. And you have to just go with that, because that's its thesis, right? Mm-hmm. This is what is truth for that book. And the Bible is making certain claims. Now, either you have to reject the entire Bible, because this is the way that it says you need to read me, that this is the word of God, and I declare the end from the beginning. And so it's totally okay if I tell you things in the future. Even it even proves the Bible correct. But you can't start approaching it from an external reference point because it is written as its reference. Every book is actually written as its own reference. Mm. Whether it's the definition used in the book or it's the names or it's the storyline. So it would not even make sense, like you said, as a Christian, to be questioning the context.
Yeah.
Because that is the context.
Yeah. And God tells you from the beginning, it's divine instruction manual. So to reject that.
If that's not the case, then you can close shop now.
Throw the whole thing. Yeah. Throughout the whole thing, get rid of the Bible, get rid of the whole, like, really, it's the glue that holds the whole thing together is the fact that it's divine and tells the beginning from the end. So then the second point, because I moved Greek loanwords down to the third one because it's such a weak point. The strongest point, the Syriac one, also lacks any real teeth. Let's look at deeper in this. It says Daniel is not named in the Syriac. Daniel is not the only name missing from the Syriac, though. So basically the contention is this Ben Sira, 150 years later, in his writings, mentions several canonized books, but didn't mention Daniel. But he also didn't mention Job, Ezra, Esher. Others were left absent from the list. So are we going to say that those other books aren't canonical either? So it just because something is not there doesn't mean that in another place, like the silence doesn't mean that the book was rejected or written at a later date. The Syriac reflects the particular interests, theological perspectives, and the religious and social context of Ben Sira, a scribe 150 years after Jesus. So the uncanonized text was never meant to, nor can indeed act as arbiter to determine the book of Daniel's 6th century composition. So just because it's there doesn't mean it has any value to provide us on the 6th century composition issue.
And you would have to take him as more of authority than the scripture itself.
Yeah.
So if you want to do that, you're welcome to do so. But that would not be, like you said, a good judicial argument in a courtroom.
Yeah, and now you're a follower of Ben Sira instead of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Again, because you're denying the divinity of the book to begin with. So it's like this slippery slope that happens. And the last piece is these Greek loanwords. And I just want to point out the ridiculousness of this. There are 11,000 words in Daniel, over 11,000 words. And only 4 of them in the whole book are Greek. And they are repeated 3 times for a total of 12 instances. But there's only 4 words. And they all relate to the description of a musical instrument that has no impact on the text's doctrinal meanings nor the date of origin whatsoever. So what happened was basically as the Greek Empire is kind of like budding and growing, you had this crossover in certain areas where certain pieces would be used, like music inferences or references. But when it came to the core understanding, the interpretation of the text,
yeah,
there wasn't anything but Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic.
Some of the words we use are from other languages and other countries and other regions and even from farther back. And so, it, like you said, it's a really weak argument.
Let's say this is an anonymous Jewish scribe in the year, the 2nd century BC. And he's like writing in ancient Greek or ancient Hebrew and ancient Aramaic. And then just for 4 words, just like changes only these 4 words. Why just those 4 words? Why wouldn't he wrote more in Greek? Why would this? So like there's all these other pieces where, again, in the court of evidence, this would be very circumstantial, not direct. Very little weight would be given to this. So it's just one more point I kind of want to make. In thinking about being this anonymous Jewish scribe all these years after these events, the intricacy of the day-to-day life that's happening in Daniel's life. If you and I were to try to write about somebody several hundred years ago, even with the internet, it would be hard for us to capture what it was really like as if we were living there. Mm-hmm. If you read an account from someone who's there versus someone who's written later, it could still be accurate and filled with details, but there's something different about the personal nature of the account that's going on. And think about this scribe, had no internet. Didn't have necessarily access to the intricacy of the information that we see in Daniel of day-to-day life in Babylon and the transition between the Babylon and Medo-Persian empires. Yeah. Is something, again, that's, if people are looking at this, should really weigh that as they consider whether this makes more sense in the accuracy written from somebody who's actually there or somebody who's there, wasn't there and lived hundreds of years later.
And even another point on there as well, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, actually wrote one of the chapters in the book of Daniel, and we know when he was reigning, mm-hmm. and we know when he took you know, Jerusalem captive and all these kinds of things. So we have these dates. So you'd have to be in denial of a lot in order to have this argument make sense, and in denial of the book itself. And then if you're in denial of the book itself, because the book itself says it was written during King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, then if you're denying that, then you might as well just deny the whole book.
Yeah, and that's what it becomes, like this slippery slope. Now, this is just offsetting their powerful points, which I think all three are extremely weak. But now let's just look at the evidence for the 6th century. Because if this is the evidence for the 2nd century, I think the evidence is more compelling for the 6th. Now, this is the minority view, but all traditional scholars, it's pre-18th century scholars agreed, regardless, Protestant, Catholic, Islamic, rabbinic, didn't matter. The view states that Daniel was written by the historical person Daniel, who lived during the Babylonian and early Persian empires of the 5th and 6th century BC. This view is supported by historical and archaeological evidence of the book's existence prior to the 2nd century BC, as well as its detailed descriptions of the Babylonian and Persian periods during the 6th century BC, and is further supported by an analysis of the linguistic composition of the book, which is composed of both Hebrew and Aramaic.
Yeah.
This is going to be incredible. I found this to be incredible. So just to give people an idea of how recent, this is called recency bias, how our recent modern scholar, our recency bias, is letting us forget all of this time where it was established that this was the case. So between the time Daniel lived and up to the 1700s and 1800s, it was uniformly agreed on when it was written. Then, do you remember what happened around the 1700s, 1800s that came up and changed everything?
Well, we have the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
We have Age of Enlightenment. We have, actually, deism was starting to get a really big hold in things. Evolution started around that time.
Yes.
All these isms.
Yes. And so this Age of Enlightenment, all they did was get more ignorant about the divine nature of God.
Yeah.
And we see between the 2nd century, the ones who believe the 2nd century BC are only from the 1800s to today. And the number one reason, as we've looked at, is disbelief versus what we're going to look at here. And one of those proofs is going to be the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were dated back to 100, 200 BC era. But the Dead Sea Scrolls are one piece, and we've looked at the Cyrus Cylinder before, which confirms a bunch of details found in the book of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
It collaborates the policy of Cyrus regarding the Jewish people and the restoration of their temples, which we looked at was how Trump is being typed as a Cyrus for rebuilding the temple. And then the Cyrus Cylinder had detailed information about events, customs, and languages, both Hebrew and Aramaic, that match the book of Daniel. The Dead Sea Scrolls were among the manuscripts. Now, the Dead Sea Scrolls dating to 200 BC indicates that the text was already considered an authoritative source well before that they're there. Because imagine you find these things that date back 200 and it's already in there.
Mm-hmm.
That would infer that the book was authored prior to the date that they said.
Yep.
Now, the most important, I think one of the most powerful proofs for this is the linguistic analysis. When you look at the book of Daniel, it's comprised of Hebrew and Aramaic. One of the most fascinating things I found is the portion that was written in Aramaic is from Daniel 2 to Daniel 7. What happens in that Daniel 2 to Daniel 7 window?
Well, that's all the prophetic things in the book of Daniel.
All the future kingdoms, the little horns in there. Yep. You're going to get all of the things that say is going to happen in the future. And God wrote it in Aramaic instead of Hebrew. Why would he do something like that?
Well, because it was a different form of Aramaic than later Aramaic.
Yes. So by the very fact that he put that section in Aramaic, he proved that no one in the future could come back and say this was written in the future because I put it in 5th, 6th century Medo-Persian Aramaic. Yeah. And I did it specifically in the parts that predicted the future kingdoms so nobody could come back and say it was written in a future date.
Yeah.
Wow. Like that's incredible. I knew it was written in portions. I didn't know before doing this which portions it was written in. And I just found it absolutely floored me when you see where it picks up. Because it's actually, if you split verse 4 in chapter 2 into A and B, it starts in B. And that's right when verse 4, part B, is when he switches to start talking about the kingdoms, the future kingdoms of the world.
And it's so interesting why he would write it that way.
Yeah.
Why didn't he write it just all in Hebrew or all in Aramaic?
Yep.
And no, he did that in the specific way so that you would see that there was an intricacy and an intention behind that.
Even in starting the chapter, he didn't write all of 2 in Aramaic. He wrote the first part in Hebrew, and then 1-4, God's like, okay, it's time to make my stamp. I'm going to show all future generations that I can see the beginning from the end. And that's why he put it in the Aramaic of the time. Incredible stuff. But even the word order, the subject, object, verb, word order aligns more with the Aramaic of the 5th, 6th century. So how do we know it's Medo-Persian from the 5th, 6th century? You can break these things down and compare them and see that it's from that era. So I found that very compelling. Now, I'd say the most compelling evidence of all for the 6th century authorship is written by the Jewish historian Josephus and Origen, that both mark historical events that people today still use them as accurate historians. And here they both talk about an incident with Alexander the Great, where Alexander's like taking the world over and he arrives into Jerusalem with his armies. And the high priest comes out of the temple in his full high priest garment and shows him the book of Daniel and says, "You will rule."
Yeah.
And then the origin version says that Alexander said he had a dream that he was going to meet a man that looked exactly like that, and that that man would tell him he would subjugate the world, or in this case, subjugate all of Asia. So that was done before 167 BC. This is like 300-something BC. Yeah. And here you have a historical, literal nation of Israel keeping these records and understanding these things, that this event took place. It could not have happened unless Daniel was in existence.
And the fact that they knew and that the high priest could come out and give that means they understood what was being written there.
Yes.
They were seeing, oh, this is the sequence of events. Because in the book of Daniel, and this is in chapter 8, and our subject matter, which is the later part of chapter 9, is just 8. Being finished.
The finalization of chapter 8.
And chapter 8 is all about showing that it went from Medo-Persia to Greece by name. And so all they had to do was acknowledge the book of Daniel as an authoritative source from God, which obviously they did, come out and say, hey, this is you.
Yep. And they understood the fact that it wasn't just Greece. It says that the first king was going to be the prominent one. And so
come out.
They literally, when Alexander walked in, already knew these things. It makes you wonder if they understood Daniel 9:24-27, if there are some that do and just don't want to listen to what it says. But these types of things, did the second century group have anything like this? Dead Sea Scrolls, Medo-Persian Aramaic from the 5th or 6th century, 2 reputable historians, both citing events that predate what they say.
It's all just based on disbelief.
Yeah, it's based on, and a rejection of the evidence.
In a court of law, it is easier to prove the existence of something than the non-existence of something. You have to have that much more evidence proven to non-existence than the existence. Mm. And the fact that so far our evidence counts are way more on the existence shows even stronger that that is most likely the case.
I agree. And I think that, again, like I'm a weight of evidence guy. I don't think any one thing, you have to look at the whole picture. And to me, when you stack them up side by side, the evidence for the second century is very weak, regardless of the evidence for the sixth. But then when you consider the sixth century evidence also, it becomes almost illogical. And here we saw the Wikipedia people making fun of people who said that the sixth century authorship was legitimate. Archaeology, Dead Sea Scrolls, and Jewish written history. Alexander the Great walking into Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And this is direct evidence versus absence from the Syriac and Greek loanwords. That's circumstantial. So I think anybody looking at this logically would be able to arrive that the weight of evidence is certainly on the side of the 6th century authorship. And I think that there, you know, the devil's constantly working, including in modern scholarship, Bible scholarship today. It's not like it's excluded from his reach. And I think the reason that they're trying to skew this is because of how accurate Daniel is. It tells you the 4 kingdoms of the world prior to their existence. It cites Greece and identifies the first king over 200 years in advance. It cites the little horn and the papacy over 1,000 years in advance. It gives the 70-week prophecy and the conditions for Israel that they must meet as a nation before their probation closes. It gives 2,300-day prophecy for the cleansing of the sanctuary, which we're going to look at the heavenly sanctuary at some point. We know there's people who have asked, what's the heavenly sanctuary and what is it? And we can get into all that. the short answer of it. Just give us the short answer. What's the heavenly sanctuary?
Well, the heavenly sanctuary, so this is a really important point. And some people may and may not understand it, but the temple that was put on earth, or the tabernacle, I could say, because first it was the tabernacle in the wilderness and then the temple that was built, was only a replica of what the actual temple is, or sanctuary is, in heaven. So going back through the entire history to the plan of salvation, when the fall took place, there needed to be something to do to fix this, to remove our sin and make it so that we wouldn't have to taste of the second death and lose our salvation and our eternal life. So the sanctuary was built. And then we had this priestly service that was actually atoning for our sins. And this is a physical, literal temple in heaven called the sanctuary in heaven.
And John the Revelator saw it, and a bunch of other prophets saw it. They saw the lamps and the candlesticks and the everything.
The table of showbread, yeah. The incense, the altar, the mercy seat, the throne, the angels, the everything.
Yeah.
So we have this sanctuary in heaven. And when we're looking at the course of history, all history is actually encompassed through different portions or stages of what's happening in the heavenly sanctuary. And then what we had on earth with the Israelites going through the wilderness and all the sacrificial service and the types and the feasts was only a foreshadow and only a taste of a visualization of what was happening in the heavenly sanctuary. Mm-hmm. So this was so they could understand, oh, this is what Christ is doing for us actually, yeah. Because these lambs and the wheat and the barley and wasn't doing actually anything for their sin. It was only a type. And by them taking the action, it showed their faith. But when we're dealing with some of these events here, that are considering after Jesus died on the cross, which then would cause the oblation, the sacrifices to cease. That's why we don't keep the feast anymore, and that's a whole nother topic. Then the process went into the heavenly sanctuary. And when Christ left earth, he went directly to the holy place in the sanctuary in heaven. So this is a literal place when we say, oh, we're in the most holy place experience, or the Day of Atonement, or the holy place, or, you know, this thing. This is actually physically taking place. It says Christ is our high priest, and that means he is literally our high priest in heaven.
Yeah, and people most religions or most denominations don't understand this or teach this, but Jesus is in the heavenly sanctuary right now, just like the high priest was in the sanctuary service during the Day of Atonement.
Yeah.
And we are in this last Day of Atonement, but Christ didn't just go up there and is like waiting around. He has this priestly ministry work that he's been doing.
Yes.
And we're going to cover this at great length in the future, but for people asking, the short answer is the heavenly sanctuary is where Jesus is right now. That is a reflection of what was on earth, but is the real yeah. one, not made with hands, as the book of Hebrews points out. So all this touches back to the Daniel 8 and 9. This is the 2300 days, the yeah. sanctuary being cleansed. And then it gives a final culmination of all the events in human history in maybe the greatest detail in conjunction with Revelation to reveal what happens at the end of time.
And so obviously this is not an exhaustive list
certainly
of
not.
Everything in the book of Daniel, because we could go on for months and years on what's in there. So
yeah, and we already are long in our episodes. We're not going to go that long.
Some of the highlights,
yeah.
I guess you could say.
And in conjunction to what we're talking about specifically in this episode. But if you're the devil, is Daniel a book you want people to understand?
Absolutely not.
No. And so you're going to focus on muddying the waters as much as possible for these Daniel books, because it's so much information exposing who the power players are and who the power is behind it, mm-hmm. and what tools they're going to use to get all this. So now we can finally start to touch on the overview of the 70 weeks in Daniel 9.
Yeah.
But before we even get there, we still got to understand more, because now we understand when Daniel was composed and how these views kind of all look towards the 70 weeks. We got to look at the connection between Daniel 8 and Daniel 9. But before we get there, just to give people an overview, by the time we're in Daniel 9, it's around the year 538 or 539 BC. Mm-hmm. We're in Babylon. It's just been conquered by Cyrus. It's the end of Babylon and kind of the Medo-Persian Empire's rising. And it's in the first year of Darius, the son of Azarias, who was made ruler over the Babylonian kingdom. And Daniel realizes that the 70-year captivity period prophesied by Jeremiah is nearing its end with Cyrus's victory. So even Daniel is acutely aware of where he is in history to understand that the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah, yep, he was living in, and that the Babylonian king losing to Cyrus marked the end, potential end. But Daniel's nervous that maybe the Jewish people didn't do what they were supposed to do, and yep, that this time period might be extended. Mm-hmm. So this prompts in his prayer of confession and supplication, where he seeks God's mercy not to extend the timeline, but to fulfill his promise to restore his city and his people. And as it says, Daniel's praying, and the angel Gabriel starts to speak to him, telling Daniel he's going to give him skill and understanding.
Yep.
So hopefully this sets the stage where we're at and what's happening with Daniel. And now we're going to kind of look at Daniel 20 through 27. And we're just going to read through. So people who have never seen this before, or maybe aren't familiar, we're just going to read it through so everyone can see it. Do you want to start us off?
And I want to say one thing before we begin. Like when it says Gabriel came and said, I will give you skill and understanding. That phrase, give you skill and I'll give you understanding, I'll tell you the truth. This is like all terms that's used all throughout the book of Daniel and Revelation. That means that this is not garbed anymore. This is the actual explanation now. So if this is the explanation, that means it has to be referring to something. So that's what we're saying, that chapters 8 and 9 are connected. Mm-hmm. But when we look at this, he's giving him the understanding of what he was just seeing that he couldn't even fully comprehend.
Yeah.
So starting in verse 20, Daniel 9 and verse 20, and whilst I was speaking and praying and confessing my sins and the sins of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, whilst I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And I just referenced the oblation. Oblation is the sacrificial system.
And we're going to break all this down more later. So just to touch that, he is confessing his sin and the sins of the people of Israel. I talked to Jewish people quite a bit today, and a lot of them don't acknowledge the whole sin confessing.
Right.
They think that's a very Christian thing. But here it is, Daniel's doing it in the mm-hmm. Old Testament as a Jew, clearly showing that this confession, repentance, sin, baptism even, this is all
the Jewish. Bible says without confession, there's no remissions of sin.
Yes.
So, and if he's wanting this curse to end, because they're in Babylon, they've been taken out of their land, there was a curse put on Israel, and he's saying, Lord, maybe at least you keep me, take them. You know, he's saying, forgive me for my sins.
Yeah.
And he's doing his part. His part is to confess his sins and make sure he's right with God, because Daniel is what we should be doing.
Yeah.
We should be doing the same actions that he did. Totally. Number one, we shouldn't be embarrassed of our faith. And then number two, we need to be confessing our sins and making sure we're right with God, especially in the times that we're living in.
Amen. Okay, so let's continue. We'll dig into this more later, but just we're just familiarizing ourselves. And he informed me and talked with me and said, oh, Daniel, I'm now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. And look at when this came to up in front of God. At the beginning of thy supplication, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision.
70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. And obviously, we have highlighted here a couple key points, and we could go into every word, and we will.
Yeah.
So don't get bogged down if this is new for you.
We'll get to it. We're gonna break all this down. Just get familiar with it, and then also know that Messiah, the Prince, the Jewish translation says the Anointed or an Anointed One, and we're gonna tackle that later for any possible of our Jewish brothers and sisters that are out there. We're acknowledging that in their translation it doesn't say Messiah but an Anointed, but we're gonna arrive at how we can realize the Anointed is Jesus. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the Prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So there's like a lot of scary language in here for people who don't understand necessarily what this means, maybe aren't well-schooled. We read the King James Version exclusively, so sometimes this is a little heavy for people, but we're going to make the difficult simple as possible. And it really is pretty straightforward when you start breaking this all down.
You just have to go slow.
Yeah.
And once you start understanding, you know, the principles in the Bible here a little and there a little and using the Bible to interpret itself, it's not as scary and complex as it seems.
Absolutely. I mean, if someone like me can learn this stuff, literally anybody can. There's nothing special about about my brain, except for what God is able to do with it, of course. But we have questions that come out of this. And these are questions like, it doesn't matter if you agree with our view. You should be asking these questions regardless. Just going in there and questioning everything and making sure that you're sound in what you believe and why. I'm not going to read through all these because we're going to cover all of them. We're not going to do it in this episode or the next, but a combination of them as we kind of move forward. Before we can ask these questions, we've got to connect Daniel 8 and 9. We've mentioned it a couple times, but to people who are like, okay, well, how? Why? Why do we need to connect these? So let's go through connecting these and see if what we've said is true. So the 70 weeks of Daniel 9 is the closing of the vision that starts in Daniel 8. I want people to realize that. In chapter 8, Daniel receives a vision of a goat, a ram, and a little horn, in addition to a time prophecy that mentions 2,300 days and something about a sanctuary being cleansed. An angel tells Daniel the meaning of the vision from the ram, the goat, and the little horn. All this is contained in 8. And I'm just going to quickly review because we're not going to go into the chapter. I thought about doing that, but we'd be here forever. So the verses 1 through 3 is the vision of the ram with two horns. Verses 4 through 7 is the battle between the goat and the ram. And then by verse 8, the goat's horn breaks and splits into 4. Yeah. Then in verse 9, this little horn emerges. And 10 through 12, you get a description of this little horn. And it fights directly against Jesus Christ, who is the Prince of the Host. Now, obviously, the Jews don't say that. They'll have different understandings of this. But the Prince of the Host is generally understood to be Jesus. And this little horn fights it in 10 through 12. Then we're going to pick up in 13 and actually read 13 and 14 because we've seen that Daniel has this vision. He's got these components. And then let's see what happens in Daniel 8, 13 and 14.
So it says in verse 13, "Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot." Verse 14, "And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed."
And I have a couple things here. The first is we italicize the vision. This is going to be, the vision is going to be this linking word that carries us through 8 and 9 to make sure we stay on track with which vision we're talking about. And then some of our listeners or viewers may notice that you skipped a word in there.
I did. I skipped the word sacrifice.
That's right. Why did you do that?
I did because when you're reading out of the King James, which we use the King James because it's the received text, most accurate, and we could go into a whole...
Maybe we will.
probably should.
Yeah.
It's the most accurate according to the Hebrew and Greek wording.
Yep.
And it actually italicizes the words that were not originally supplied. Mm-hmm. So sacrifice is a supplied word that wasn't in the original, so I just naturally skip over it.
Yeah, yeah. And people say, well, why couldn't you do that with all supplied words? But we could get into why that is in the future. But just for now, just the vision concerning the daily, the transgression of desolation,
yeah,
to the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot. This is the theme that we're focused on. And then the 2,300 days.
Yeah. That's the main question here that's being asked.
Yeah.
And Daniel's asking, actually, it's the saint that's asking, how long shall be the vision?
Mm-hmm.
And really, in this wording, it doesn't give it perfectly, but it would really more be easily understood as how much longer, how long or longer shall be the vision? Because yeah, Daniel's already in Babylon.
Yeah.
So Daniel's like feeling this. He's like, we're in this time frame. Oh, okay. So he's going to, you know, he's asking the question, how much longer is this going to be? And then Daniel doesn't actually get the answer immediately after these verses.
No. In fact, this is kind of the first phase. We get the ram, the goat, the little horn, the fight with the prince of the power of the host. Then it's the saint comes and says, how long is the vision? And he said 2,300 days and it'll be fixed. It'll yeah, sanctuary be cleansed. Okay. So then the next 15 through 22 gives us the total interpretation. Like, this is one of the most frustrating points for me as a witnessing in the world, and especially witnessing online. The majority of people who look at Daniel 2:7-8, they do not see Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, Rome.
Yeah.
They don't see Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus the Great, Alexander the Great, Julius Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
And when I press people on these, well, in verses 20, when it says this ram is the king of Medo and Persia, why do you think it's something else? And then they stop responding to me. They stop. Yeah. I say, but what it says that the king of Greece is 21 and the great horn will be the first king. Why would you say it's something else? They yeah, say it's like Donald Trump is the beast that's coming, that it's a person. But we see that it's given us who these are. And when I have just my personal experience, when I say, hey, why do you say that when it says this right here?
Yeah.
They'll literally like block me or, you know, stop talking to me and saying, oh, well, they're just pushing their ideologies. I don't understand why we can't just take the text for as clear as it is, especially yeah, I get having places where we can have dialogue on things, but it couldn't get much more clear than what this interpretation gives us, these figures. It says, Daniel seeks the understanding of his vision, and the angel Gabriel is instructed to explain it to him. Gabriel identifies the ram as the king of Medo Persia, verse 20. The goat is explained as the king of Greece, verse 21. And the great horn between its eyes is identified as the first king. Absolutely remarkable that it not only gets Greece right, but like says the first king is going to be the great one.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, it's easy. The first king is always the greatest one. Well, it wasn't the case in Babylon. Wasn't the case in Medo-Persia. Wasn't the case in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's remarkable accuracy. After Alexander's death, symbolized by the breaking of the horn, his empire is divided into four parts, represented by the four horns that rise in the place of one, out of verse 22. These do not possess the same power as Alexander. They were weaker than him. And what does history show? Like,
100% accuracy. Alexander broke into his four generals and, you know, Seleucus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Lysimachus. We have these four branches and, you know, the Bible doesn't miss a beat.
Yeah. And if the people freaking out looking at this, oh, it has to be written in the second century then. Lean on your weight of evidence. Your weight of evidence proves that this was written yeah, before in the 6th century BC.
If it's that accurate, and it's saying that it was written here, and it has proof for that, then case closed. It's just amazing how it flows.
And not limiting what God's able to do, I think. Fine, if you want to be an atheist and say it to you blue in the face, but don't be a Christian and say that it's written in the second century because you deny the divinity of God's abilities. Okay, so then verses 23 through 26, we have the emergence again. This is the explanation of the vision. We got the vision. Then he says, how long? The 2,300 days. Now explanation. Now we're into the little horn section of this explanation. The emergence of the little horn is described as occurring during the latter period of the divided Greek Empire. The horn is commonly interpreted as the papacy in this framework. And this is not an Adventist doctrine. I feel like we've said this till we're blue in the face. This is a Protestant doctrine. We've looked at Luther and Huss and Jerome and Tyndale and John Knox, and you go down the list. They all said the same thing. It is described as a king of fierce countenance and growing exceedingly great. It is also noted that this power will act against the Prince of Princes, interpreted as Christ.
Yeah. And I just want to add one thing there. Not only just the papacy, but like that conversion from Rome, like pagan Rome, into that
right
papal power.
That's
right?
True. That's true. So it didn't just jump from Greece into papal right. Rome. You had pagan Rome, which birthed papal Rome. Yeah. That was all part of this as well.
But the amazing thing about Daniel 8 versus Daniel 2 and 7, because Daniel 2 is this image. Mm-hmm. And for those who aren't aware, there's many of these prophecies, symbolic prophecies in Daniel. They're not that scary to understand, but we have this statue, and each metal represents a different kingdom: Babylon, Medo Persia, Greece, pagan Rome. And we have in this one, it seems a bit funny because this little horn, instead of coming out of the beast, the fourth beast in Daniel 7, because in Daniel 7, it has a lion, a bear, a leopard, and then a terrible beast, and that mm-hmm. terrible beast is representative of Rome. But the interesting thing is that Daniel 8 is almost like a repeat, but an enlargement of the greater details mm-hmm. of the Medo-Persian and Greece empires, which Rome actually came out of Greece. That's actually how that took place. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, wow, we have even more detail of the formation of this little horn that came out of
where here. Did it come from? It came from, and you look at the gods of Rome, they're just the gods of Greece transferred over, you know, Jupiter and Zeus. And
yeah.
And you just see like it got birthed out of, it's exactly as the Bible said, it got birthed out of Greece. Okay, so the overview of 8 is the first part is the vision. The second part is the explanation, but you see the vision, we have goat, explanation, goat, Greece, ram, ram, Medo-Persia, little horn, papacy, or we'll say the Roman power typified by the little horn papacy at the end. But what we don't have is any start date for the 2300 days.
Right.
How are we supposed to know when this starts? And this is where Daniel 9:23 through 27 finishes the vision. And I want people to realize, why did this happen? Because Daniel is so overwhelmed by what he's seen. And it says in 8:27, and I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business. Like, he has a regular job too. Yeah. He has to like go to work. And I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. Again, the vision is going to be very important.
That's amazing, because if you can just imagine Daniel, he's in Babylon. He understands that, you know, if they repent, that hopefully they'll be led back to their land. That's what he's hoping for anyways. And then the angel comes to him and tells him all this amount of time, and then says to him 2,300 more days or 2,300 more years, because Daniel understands what that means. He's like, I can't even imagine that it's not going to happen for 2,000 more years, and he just gets sick, and he just can't even understand what's happening.
I can't imagine how overwhelming all that would be.
Yeah,
you know, seeing it in being actually there, and Gabriel, and oh man. So yes, it is very overwhelming, and God kind of like cuts it off and is like, "I'm going to come back, because the second
let
part
that sit with you for a minute."
Yeah, and these 2,300 days is so much that if I added that on top, he may not have even been able to comprehend it all. So now let's bring it all together, and we're going to close out by sharing this conjunction of 8 and 9, merging them together. 8, 14, and 16. Behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man, Gabriel. Verse 9, 21. Next chapter. While I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel. So Gabriel's in both accounts. It says 8, 15, even I, Daniel, had the vision. 9, 21, whom I had seen in the vision, what?
At the beginning.
So by the time we're in 9, he doesn't use vision as a new vision. He's saying the vision that I was having at the beginning, back in chapter 8. Let's keep going. It says in 8:16, a man's voice said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. That voice isn't Gabriel's. Whose is that?
That's God's voice.
Yeah. And so it's God's voice telling Gabriel, go tell this man to understand again the vision. By 9:23, he says, Gabriel, go tell this man the vision. And then here's Gabriel saying, at the beginning of the supplication, I got a command to come forth and show. Well, the command was in 8:16.
Yeah.
And then says, therefore, understand the matter and consider the vision, connecting back to Daniel 8. Daniel 8:17 says, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Yeah. By 8:26, he says, in the vision of the evening and the morning, which shall be told, wherefore shut up thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. So he's telling you, this is going to be for the end of time. And he said, unto 2,300 days, and the sanctuary shall be cleansed. And then by 9:22, he's saying, I've come to give you understanding regarding what? The 2,300 days. Yeah. So we see these connections don't seem to stop. 8 and 9 are intricately involved. And anybody who's telling you they understand the interpretation for 9, especially 9 through 24, and don't take you back to Daniel chapter 8, well, I'm sorry to say, their interpretation is not going to be very strong because they didn't use the framework of the foundation to understand by the time you get to that 9th chapter what's going on there. And while we're talking about like 9, 24 through 27, there's so much to cover we didn't even get to it in this episode.
Yeah.
But we're going to start the next episode and we're going to just keep chipping away because this is such an important deal. And if people can just leave this episode with two things, one, that the book of Daniel is unequivocally written in the 6th century BC, and two, that the 2300 days and the vision in and the interpretation in Daniel 9, 8 and 9, they're connected.
Yes.
So just leave with those two things and that will give us a foundation take in the next episode where we will start taking apart the pieces of Daniel 9, 24 through 27.
And while you're waiting for the next episode, you should take a look at those two points and really study that yourself.
Yeah.
Take a good amount of time, understand that, read through chapter 8, chapter 9, get a good context. It's going to be a lot. Maybe you won't understand it. But when I'm studying through a chapter in the Bible, I will read the whole thing from start to finish just to read it. And then go back to the start and then start really dissecting. But you need that context. That's really important.
Yeah.
So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you for watching. Please like, share, and subscribe. Share this with your friends, your family. Go to ADTV Watch. Make a login. Go on any of our other social media platforms, whether that be Facebook, Telegram, Instagram, any of the other ones. And we'll see you in the next episode. God bless.